everybody. Welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. This is episode 18, and today we'll be covering the baffling disappearance of Joan Risch, a 31-year-old wife and mother who mysteriously vanished from her Lincoln, Massachusetts home on the afternoon of October 24, 1961, leaving a bloody crime scene in her wake. But first, I just want to quickly thank everybody for listening and offering feedback. The show is growing all the time, and your support has been amazing. Remember, you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and I always love hearing from people, so don't be shy. In addition to that, I'm working on some really cool merch that should be available soon, and also in the process of creating a Patreon page, so be on the lookout for these announcements in the coming weeks. Of course, I've also received some great recommendations for cases to cover in the future, so keep sending them and maybe I'll pick yours to appear on the show. And that's enough of that. Let's do this. But with a quick warning, I'm about to ramble for 20 minutes about things that have nothing to do with this case, until they suddenly do. And it's going to be absolutely crazy. But the following insights reveal the answers to what happened to Joan Risch when she vanished from her comfortable suburban life, leaving behind nothing more than a trail of blood. So what I want to do here is start from the beginning, because I think the implications of Joan's childhood factor very heavily into the events that ultimately occurred on that fateful afternoon in October 1961. Yet, what's so interesting about her childhood is it seems to be shrouded in mystery, almost to the extent of her disappearance. Which brings me to my first point about this case. And that's the notion that we should all be on the lookout for parallels and symbolism here that connect the adapter of her childhood to the port of her adulthood to create the conduit in which the electricity can run and allow the truth to light up in front of our eyes. We know that so much of who we are as adults, at least emotionally, is developed in our childhood. And within that consideration, the truth always seems to be that the only way we can escape the terrors of the past that still haunt us is through our actions in the present to contribute to happiness in the future. So if we make better choices as adults than those who inflicted the suffering upon us years earlier, then we will have a greater propensity to succeed despite the past. What remains, though, is the fact that you can't change this emotional imprint because it's not a stain, but truly embedded within the structural framework of your brain. And the way the past behaves within our psyche is very specific. For example, the psychological damage from the past causes us to experience emotional pain that tries to influence our choices. So the way we must live as adults, in order to be successful, is to react to those things defiantly and head on. And that is the number one element that affects people who have traumatic childhoods. They're constantly playing defense. And to understand how this transpires, we'll draw a parallel to playing defense on an American football team. So, I only played in high school, but anybody who's played even one game of football can tell you this. Playing defense is a lot more tiring than playing offense, and for one very specific reason. All of your movements are reactions, whether planned or improvised. And that same thing is the basis for a troubled mind. You try to conquer the sickness by constantly reacting in a way that you won't let it win. But the nature of the game dictates that you have to play offense to score points. And what's equally important about that endeavor is controlling the game with pace. And it's because the defense has to rest. They can't always be on the field. Statistics show that leaving your defense on the field for extended periods often has disastrous consequences. And as we always dive to the evolutionary insight of these things, notice what happens is the defense gets tired, which means one thing. Its movement has been restricted. At this point, the offense keeps the ball and torments the exhausted defense until it succumbs, and the offense wins the game for the other team, for this reason. Its movement was not restricted, and specifically because taking action consumes much less energy than reaction does. Therefore, action is the thrust of evolution, and reaction is a construct of the human mind intended for the sole purpose of negating loss in the face of evolution's plight. And it's exactly why humanity is in love with sports. It parallels the plight in our brains to achieve temporary wins by playing defense on evolution in the face of inevitable loss. Think of this the next time you take a sick animal to the vet repeatedly when the end is obviously near, or when you buy a big house for your young family knowing someday you probably won't be able to maintain it anymore and can't afford it anyway. Everything results in loss. So sticking with the sports theme here, it occurs to me that the way we live our lives is very much like somebody standing on a tennis court with tennis balls shooting out of a machine in front of them. Every ball returned is a temporary win, and every one missed is a permanent loss. So the idea is to return as many balls as possible until you get so tired you can't raise your arms, get pelted by balls, collapse, and for all intents and purposes, the game, like your life, is over. So, the more stable one's disposition, the more likely life is going to spit out the balls at a more consistent speed and pace that allows for less exhausting reactions, and also greater potential for consistent, albeit temporary, wins. So in the troubled mind, what we find is that the machine is not tuned properly, and there's a greater propensity for the balls to come out at different speeds, and also spit them out with erratic frequency, both of which make achieving temporary wins not only more tiring, but less likely. The combination of those two negative traits is a deadly cocktail because it means you have to work twice as hard for half the results. So you have a choice. You can do just that, or you can do something less than that, down to, and including, nothing. So, obviously, people want to fix the machinery, but they don't know anything about it because they're just tennis players. And this is really dangerous because what sometimes happens is they turn the machine off and look inside it, realizing nothing more than the fact it's malfunctioning, and are left to internalize the fact it's broken in the absence of the knowledge to fix it. And this is the point where some people give up. They just decide they don't want to play anymore. But some people seek help. They swallow their pride, admit they don't have the capacity to conquer the issue alone, and ask the assistance of someone who has the tool to accommodate. This can come in many forms, such as antidepressants, therapy, an exercise program, a hypnotist, whatever the case may be. But even in America, in recent history, society hasn't been sensitive enough to mental health issues to have a truthful discussion. Those days are unfolding now, but in 1961, when Joan Risch disappeared from her Lincoln, Massachusetts home, there was a strong societal desire for people to maintain appearances in favor of admitting to anything such as depression or suicidal thoughts. And this meant one thing. You often had to keep playing defense all the time against that malfunctioning machine, as it wore you down to nothing, but maintain your smile as though the opposite was true. In essence, what this creates is a situation where you're eventually going to crack, simply because you can't fool evolution. You can't behave for very long as though you're winning, when you're really losing. It catches up to you. And when it does, hiding the loss is no longer a possibility. The reason evolution imposes this punishment is because it needs to expose your weakness, specifically so that other potential predators who might be interested in acquiring your gains will be provided the opportunity to prove themselves dominant and ascend the evolutionary ladder, whether that means having your husband stolen by another woman or some guy selling his expensive TV for $10 so he can get high on crack. That's all evolution is, a game of hide and seek, hiding in our minds and seeking out in the world. Our true intentions, therefore, always lie in the subtext of what we say because of a single factor. We're always trying to take something from each other. It isn't just a reason to lie, it's the only reason we lie, because we don't do anything but want. We are nothing more than a series of desires. Now, within the execution of those desires, evolution provides the highest ROI to those who are least desperate, and the lowest return on investment to those who are most desperate, simply by default of the fact desperation precipitates risk, and unnecessary risk, which in turn offers situations with a low percentage of converting into a win. For example, if you work really hard for decades and make $50 million, it stands to reason you'll reap the benefits of doing so. However, if you steal $50 million, the risk involved says you'll likely get caught, imprisoned, etc., something that will ultimately restrict your movement and participation in evolution. The same thing goes with identity. If you're a teen emo, your identity is gone the moment you take off all the black and remove the piercings. But if you're a successful business person and take off your clothes for a shower, your identity is perfectly intact. The reason for this is because young people fabricate identity out of experimentation born of desperation, meaning they're simply old enough to have identities, but until they have the life experience to fully create them, they make transparent attempts at pretending the decision to look this way, or any other way for that matter, from a jock to a hipster, is actually genuine. Because the alternative is admitting you have no identity, or a lack of sufficient identity beyond your name and what school you attend. So while you build yours as you head into adulthood, the desperation lessens with the accumulation of experiences that solidify that identity. But that's the normal course of events, from an individual standpoint, and absent of any societal considerations. So in terms of 1961 America, it was common for men to treat women in a manner that would leave them collectively feeling oppressed, and subsequently, repressed, And we need to look no further than dictatorships, ruled with an iron fist, to understand that the purpose of oppression and repression is to create collective identity absent of individual considerations, as it pertains to desire. And what does this control? At its root? Movement. So when a dictator comes into power, the individuals under his rule must then abide by an identity forced upon them, one that was outside the control of their true desires. And it's as though this identity just appeared, much like the emo, and so it seems wholly false to their adult minds to crave freedom in the form of movement to join evolution's plight by specifically engaging the desires that form their identity. So if you find yourself in a situation where you feel oppressed and repressed, and by way of an identity this seems to have just suddenly appeared and will never go away because those inflicting it have the power, what do? You respond in a manner that will reflect that pain like a mirror, which is to say that you'll make that identity suddenly disappear by secretly leaving and never coming back, and specifically by way of a desperate event offering low ROI on the chances of success, a journey with dangers you know could potentially end in death. But this happens every day. This is the plight of the refugee. And this is also Joan Risch. So let's revisit the parallel of evolution being an American football game. When you're playing defense, as someone who's being oppressed, your only chance to reverse your circumstances in a single action is to take back your freedom, the ball, which represents the power, by scoring a definitive win in a single play by way of an interception where you don't get tackled running for the end zone. It happens all the time, but the majority of the time it doesn't. The ball carrier is most often swarmed and tackled before he can escape to freedom. The same goes for any person or group trying to escape the actions of another, more powerful person or group trying to suppress their desires. It's a low percentage play, but the first thing you notice about interceptions, as opposed to receptions made by the offense, is that the crowd roars as though this turn of events is surely going to end in a score. But in reality, you just have two catches where it's equally probable that the ball carrier will be tackled. However, the interception incites far more excitement because it unfolds initially as something that puts the power back in your hands, whereas the reception starts as something where you had the power. This is the underdog rising. It's the little guy and gal finally getting their due. But the inherent sadness in this is that you quickly realize you're alone with the ball and the entirety of the other team is going to squash your desires. So you have the power now, but your confidence quickly dissolves to denial because the odds against succeeding have actually gotten far worse, even sometimes reaching the point of impossibility. But you're in a position where you already have the ball running for the end zone. There's no going back. But the problem with this is that you must move forward with denial substituted for confidence, because the truth already has you dead before you know it. Your only job at that point is to allow the events to play out as probability allows. And it happens no matter what decision you make or what direction you travel. That's the only mystery in the interception, predicting the desperate road the player will follow in an attempt to overcome the circumstances where failure seems inevitable by way of probability. And like we said, it usually ends badly. Now let's look at why. So let's circle back to the example of stealing $50 million and examine the implications of a bank robbery as it parallels the disappearance we're about to discuss in detail. Though a bank robbery certainly wouldn't garner that kind of cash, we're just using it as an example of value. And by the way, you could make this comparison with anything. And I mean anything. Everything is everything. It's a theme I promote heavily only because it's how I see things. So I know we're going deep here without even getting into the story, but trust me that the roadmap for what happened the day Joan Risch disappeared is everything we're discussing now, and will inform our insight as we move through the trail of evidence. Now, let's say I'm a first-time bank robber, but at this point I'm only contemplating it by casing the place to find if it's the right opportunity. It's just a seed in my mind. This is the equivalent of a defensive player on a football team seeing the quarterback's eyes and fantasizing for the first time about where the ball might be thrown based upon his information. At its core, the question I'm asking at this point is this. Is it worth it to make a move on the ball? Because if you jump as a defensive player and commit to this action, you could get burnt if the situation suddenly goes awry, meaning the quarterback turns and throws the ball elsewhere. But no matter the situation, once you commit, this is the classic snatch and grab that people constantly try to perpetrate on evolution. They just reach out and take the power they want. but power in this world is predicated upon numbers for that very reason. So that when you circumvent the natural process for acquiring it through numbers, you get squashed with exactly that. Numbers. I mean, what is it the police have that criminals don't, in any given crisis? It's numbers. Evolution maintains civility in our world by only extending significant and long-lasting power to those who control, or influence, large numbers of people. Ultimately, in any given situation, evolution maintains numbers in its favor. It is no different than the police force in your city. In fact, evolution's plight is the police force in your city. If you look at history, taking World War II as a profound, somewhat recent example, there was never a time when the result of that conflict was in doubt. There's a very strong narrative that's been painted as a portrait of near defeat, but by default of the nature of evolution, it is simply not possible for evil people to gain and maintain control of everything for purposes antithetical to evolution's plight. And that's what the Nazis did. They tried to draw up their own game plan for Mother Nature, and she said fuck that, specifically in the form of calling upon numbers. It's the reason people so willingly and enthusiastically signed up to potentially die for this cause. It was a worldwide conflict, with the plight of humanity at stake. In cases like this, evolution rallies in a big way. Accordingly, more people wanted to kill Nazis than join them, and their defeat, despite the fact it came with unspeakable suffering and death for millions of people, was unquestionably inevitable, because genocide is an atrocity just short of total destruction of the earth, and occurrences like these are nothing more than the times in history where we see the extreme of the scale. But the conclusion is absolutely never in doubt, and it's because this exists within the structural framework of our brains. The end result is we spend the entirety of history claiming the apocalypse is upon us, but the apocalypse is impossible. So is trashing the earth beyond habitation and finding ourselves shit out of luck. It's a joke. We are designed to consume resources in an effort to evolve. When we get to the point the planet is no longer a place humans can live, we'll have evolved to alternate accommodations. It isn't speculation. It's inevitability. Because it's numbers. But it's the simplest numbers game. You never have to do the math. You just have to look inside a casino and see the truth. The odds are always in favor of the house. Unless you cheat. Because the house is modeled after evolution. Its framework consists of a simple fixed numbers game that says all the games, just like all the drama and wars in life, start and end with probability. Now, there are three things you can do to try to overcome that. You can cheat, you can try to rob them, or you can try your luck at being one of the few who walks out with a profit after playing the game. But the end result, in any of these situations, or any other, is that no matter which of these actions you perpetrate, if you stay in the casino in an effort to do any one of these things for an extended period, you're ultimately going to lose everything you've gained. You're going to walk out empty-handed. This is the same ass-whipping that's been handed to evil men throughout history. And it's because we're all in the casino. The only way to win is to be the house. That's who most of us are. The gamblers, the degenerates who sit on the other side of the table hoping to win an unwinnable battle, men like Hitler, get stomped in the end. It's why somebody like Joseph Stalin can exist without consequence for his actions, but Hitler was the target of too many countries to even count. It's for this simple fact. Stalin contained his brutality to the Soviet Union and a few other unlucky neighbors for the most part. So despite its widespread prevalence, it never tipped the scales to the point that Hitler's actions did, and so the threat, even though it was comprised of the same atrocities Hitler perpetrated, never put the house in danger of losing, so to speak. So basically, good in this world, in the traditional sense, is nothing more than siding with the house in the casino or the bank in the robbery, while evil is trying to beat the house or storm the bank. Notice the risk involved in either event is far greater, as it pertains to ROI, and even survival, for the side lacking numbers. Now, specifically in terms of the bank robbery, this is how it continues. You've made the decision, and you run into the bank with your gun drawn, demanding money. This is the football player taking the risk of going all out for the interception. The teller complies and hands you a sack of money. That's the interception. And notice that it truly is an interception of power, symbolically represented by money, but truly indicative of the plight of humanity. So what immediately happens is evolution reacts with numbers, in the form of people trying to alert the cops, and the cops responding to stop you, the bad guy, from this risky snatch and grab you're perpetrating. At this point, you realize that the single act of theft from Evolution has triggered an automatic response to swarm you in an effort to restrict your movement and negate your antithetical evolutionary plight. You have to get out of there fast, without being seen by cameras or leaving behind evidence. In fact, the list goes on and on, radiating outward exponentially in a series of events specifically inherent within our brains as a defense system against the fallout from evolutionary crimes. A single act, if serious enough, renders you a lifetime of culpability from what you must continually hide. And when you do, evolution, by nature of what it is, simply improves technology in an effort to catch these scumbags and eliminate them. It's why we solve murders decades after the fact and still hunt Nazi war criminals in 2017. Because evolution is a relentless motherfucker that stops at nothing to bring opponents to their knees. The best result you can ever have against it is to look over your shoulder the rest of your life. And that is actually a specifically symbolic assertion by evolution. What it's saying by making you look over your shoulder in fear is that it's coming for you, and your ignorance in looking back instead of ahead is that you can't see the inevitable darkness approaching. This is the deep end of the pool, people, where the universe flexes its muscles, and we have no business swimming in these waters because we always drown. So in the case of the disappearance of Joan Risch, who is seemingly the victim of a vicious attack perpetrated by somebody with the intent to kill, I'm instead going to show you that she was actually nothing less than the perpetrator herself, the intent being her disappearance from a mundane life that left her oppressed. Joan pulled a snatch and grab on evolution and got her ass kicked for the effort. It was tragedy, and it was inevitability. But in this case, it was not murder. So now that we've prefaced this tale with our roadmap for analysis, let's take a quick look at Joan Carolyn Bard, born May 12, 1930, in Brooklyn, New York. Now, while I don't know the specifics of the following allegations, it's reported that Joan accused her parents of sexual abuse that occurred prior to their premature deaths in 1940, due to what was often described as a suspicious house fire. And by the way, if you're wondering if there's a chance Joan set the fire, she was actually staying elsewhere that night. So, obviously, if the allegations are true, this is going to have a profound effect upon the child's psyche. Furthermore, for a child to report such things during that era in America, in defiance of their parents' wishes, would be quite rare. Of course, I don't really have the time to research this aspect extensively right now, but I think it's fair to proceed for the purposes of my analysis because, as you already know, what's going to matter most to me is not the facts, but the psychological implications of what Joan suffered and how she reacts to it. So what we learn from Joan standing up for herself in a time where such an act would be considered unacceptable is that, even at a young age, she is bold and willing to take risks in pursuit of having a life where she isn't oppressed by her environment, no matter the cost. And if she's behaving with such brazen audacity at a young age, in belief of what she knows is right, it's only going to become more feasible to retain that quality as she grows to a woman. Now, how the abuse affects her in terms of emotional damage, aside from the concepts I've already presented, is beyond the scope of what I can examine because I don't know the specific events that occurred. What I can say, however, is that we should pay particular attention to the symbolism of her parents trapped and burning inside a home, unable to escape their fate, because this is going to factor into Joan's perception of her own existence as an adult, and that's being trapped in a home life where her existence feels like hell, and desperately making one last attempt to escape the heat of the flames before succumbing like they did. And right there is the theme that's about to unfold. Escape. And I'm only wildly speculating here, but I think the events that follow are closely correlated to Joan's perpetual longing for escape, not only from the abuse, but from the horrifying memory of her parents dying so suddenly in a house fire. Both of these things had to form deep emotional scars within her psyche, and I think the combination of these two elements leads us down a road to this conclusion. Joan Risch was trapped inside a house where she wanted to escape before she burned alive. Symbolically, that was her existence on October 24, 1961, and had been every day since her childhood. The only question was this. When would she make her move? When would she see the quarterback's eyes and break for the ball? That's what we're looking for here. The moment she smashes the glass case at the jewelry shop and the alarm goes off. The moment evolution starts to swarm. You see, Joan is going to have tempting thoughts about the taste of ice cream. And when we do that, we always consider the initial bites that are like heaven. But it's not until after the tipping point of eating too much, which is like hell, that we realize what we did was engage in a system of diminishing returns, much like a drug addiction, but with sugar, where the first bite was so tempting and satisfying that every bite after needed to reach that level, but never could, leaving you consuming more and more in an attempt to achieve an unachievable goal. Ultimately, you're going to get sick, and if you were so desperate, you could actually die from consuming a massive amount of ice cream. But whether we're talking about staging your disappearance or eating too much sugar, the same thing remains true in the end. You've set a trap for yourself, and by way of denial. Now watch it unfold. It's the morning of October 24th, 1961, in Lincoln, Massachusetts, at the upper-middle-class home of Martin and Joan Risch. Of course, the way these two met is going to give us excellent insight into what may have happened to Joan that day, and it goes like this. Joan graduated from Wilson College in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, in 1952, with a degree in English literature, and got a job in publishing through the traditional route, which was becoming a secretary. It was quickly obvious Joan was ambitious, however, and soon she found herself managing the secretarial pool. Not long after, she became an assistant editor at Harcourt, Brace & World, and assumed that same role later at Thomas Y. Crowell Company. But in a very familiar twist during this era, Joan met Martin at work, where he was employed as an executive, and left her blossoming career in order to take on the role of a wife and mother who cared for the family home. And I think we need to consider how much pressure would have been on her at the time. I mean, she would have been about 26 in 1956 when she got married, and it was quite common for women to be committed with families long before that. So, Joan continuing to pursue her career aspirations would exponentially draw the ire of the general public as she aged, not to mention family and friends. And herein lies the problem. When we let go of things physically, and abruptly, as we do in relationships, the emotional attachment still remains. Indefinitely. So in 1956, we witness Joan being suddenly detached from her ambition. But that's not the most important realization for us. It's this. She did so in service of a life where every day would feel as though she was being fully oppressed by a man's desires. So we have to ask ourselves, why would she give in to this so easily if it isn't what she really wanted? And the answer is that, if she was abused as a child, she's naturally predisposed to behaving this way, which is total sacrifice of her happiness to satisfy a life she doesn't want to live. And the symbolic implications become immediately apparent. Watch what she does. After having their children, Lillian, in 1957, and David, in 1959, the Risch family eventually settled in the community of Lincoln, Massachusetts, where it seems they're going to stay for quite some time as they find themselves a nice fit in the community. So while Martin maintains his publishing career path by taking a job with a paper company, Joan is left at home with the kids. So as we've already discussed that there's no chance she could be happy with such a life, what does she do? She becomes active in the League of Women Voters. And what is the singular goal of such an organization? Change that promotes freedom. And what is freedom? Nothing more than movement. Joan was suffering badly from the effects of restricted movement, and she was pissed off at evolution, just like every person who's ever used Twitter before having coffee in the morning. Every social injustice in this world can be traced directly back to evolutionary restriction of movement imposed by numbers. Accordingly, change happens by gathering numbers, whether it's a petition or the violent overthrow of a government. But the irony in evolution is that, by definition, it's happening very quickly, but in terms of the scope of the human lifetime, it can't happen fast enough. That's the source of all the anger you have ever felt. There is nothing else that upsets you. If you examine absolutely every problem in our universe, it can be solved, in time, by way of evolution, but almost none of those concerns will be addressed within your lifetime. Because if they were, you would stop moving, and therefore, evolving. So the next time you go to explode on Facebook about some outrageous political injustice that you can't believe exists, please remember that this is nothing more than the jet fuel that propels evolution. The problem is specifically intended to exceed your lifetime so that you will absolutely never stop fighting for change. All of these things that we see as someone else's fault, where we point our fingers and scream that they're ruining the world, are nothing more than an inherent pattern in our brain chemistry designed to avoid apathy and complacency. It's just Mother Nature making the kids go outside to play instead of sitting in front of the TV doing nothing. So here's the bottom line in all of this craziness. This is what you need to know. Evolution allows change when the numbers support it. End of fucking story. That is our world. We can bitch and complain all we want, but that is one thing we can't change. When you take action in opposition to this, you get stomped. And that's the basis for the snatch and grab, the quick score, the thrilling heist, trying to outrun and outgun evolution. But at the core of this is one idea. The way you defeat numbers. Lack of detection. That's the only way to temporarily defeat evolution, by escaping the scene of the crime in the aftermath and without being seen doing it. Accordingly, what element is necessary by default of evolution being defined as quick change? Speed. Joan Risch will need to exhibit increased speed for us to detect her pulling this off. And when will she do it? When she goes for the interception of the football. When she smashes the jewelry case and runs out of the store. That's where we'll find the truth. So in the morning of October 24th, Martin Risch leaves the home for Logan Airport to catch a flight. Now I know I'm battering you with this evolutionary stuff, but we need to hit the brakes right here already and make an observation. Notice what just happened. Martin leaves the home, which is the place where Joan is feeling oppressed. His desires for her to be a wife and mother result in her repressing her own desires to satisfy his needs. Essentially, he is her captor, and due to his greater resources, he has the numbers advantage. Remember that the numbers game extends to money and bullets as soon as the number of people can be compromised. So what we have here already is a circumstance where the guard has just left his post at the gate, and Joan now finds herself the victor in the numbers game. She outnumbers his presence in the home and can escape his detection. Evolution has afforded her opportunity in the same way it would a murderer waiting outside her home. So let's take a closer look at this thing. Joan gets up, makes breakfast for the kids, and then takes her daughter Lillian to the dentist. In doing so, she leaves her 2-year-old son with neighbor Barbara Barker. After the appointment, she and Lillian go shopping at a department store. At this time, the milkman and the mailman delivered at the family home, neither of whom noted anything suspicious taking place at the time. Shortly thereafter, Joan returns with Lillian, gets David from the neighbor's house, and they return to their own home. At this point, a driver shows up to pick up Martin's suits for dry cleaning and also notes nothing suspicious taking place. Nor is the driver suspected of having done anything suspicious. When he leaves, Joan changes into a more comfortable blue house dress with white sneakers. And I have to laugh here because I think most people would observe this as an insignificant detail, but I'm immediately drawn to some evident symbolic implications. An oppressed woman who is about to disappear due to restricted movement has chosen to change into blue and white, the color of the sky above that we constantly reference in terms of our dreams, flying, being free, and reaching for the stars. And what's funny is I know Joan never even realized this. Her brain simply complied with the symbolic implications of her true desires. Don't believe me? Let's examine her shoes. What are sneakers designed for? Sports. And what is the primary element considered in their design? Speed. We put on sneakers because they allow for greater comfort at increased speeds. So we can conclude that, on the morning of October 24th, 1961, Joan Risch was seeking freedom by way of increased speed. That's our first clue in the case, and we'll see those colors again, also in relation to speed and freedom. At this point, Joan makes lunch for the children and then puts David down for a nap, which would normally last until approximately 2 p.m. At 1 p.m., neighbor Barbara Barker brings her 4-year-old son over to play with Lillian. At this time, Joan goes in and out of the house while pruning rose bushes with shears. And again, we have another moment where most people just breeze past this to make the conclusion that this is a normal everyday activity, and so it's not something one would do prior to fleeing her home in an effort to create a new life. But an hour later, she's gone, never to return. So let's take a second look. When I say roses, you think of pretty flowers, right? Exactly. You don't think of a weapon, and neither do I. In fact, I would consider the shears first, no matter how impractical for a killer to employ. But roses have thorns, and thorns have an uncanny ability to create deep wounds with very small openings, meaning that if a person is cut by one, he or she can essentially control the bleeding like a faucet by applying and releasing pressure on the wound. It's something that bleeds as easily as it stops, and that's because thorns are intended as a deterrent by nature. They are not intended to cause death. but that's in the context of nature. If, however, you employ them in a smash and grab against evolution, one that is going to require a corruption of what nature intended as the use of the thorns, you could very well cause bleeding that led to death by default of everything we just discussed. And then look at how this applies to the numbers game. If you did this, how could you expect to win? By lack of detection. And in nearly 6 decades since this crime, I'll guarantee you this is the reason no one has ever suggested the thorns from the pruned rose bushes as the origin of the blood collected at the crime scene. Let's take it a step further. To avoid detection, what do? You extend the numbers game by cutting multiple plants that leave you with a pile, leaving the one that caused harm anonymous, hence the term needle in a haystack. And notice that Joan wins to this point, because she really is controlling the numbers game. She's slapping evolution in the face and gaining confidence, which will lead to the ignorance that her winning ways are going to continue. But we know the numbers game on the smash and grab means the tables are going to turn on her, and here's where she knows she has to go for broke by breaking ranks with evolution and snatching that interception right out of the air in a desperate run for the freedom of the win afforded by the end zone. Accordingly, what activity does Barbara Barker see Joan doing? Putting the shears away in the garage. Notice there's no secrecy because she isn't trying to win that numbers game. The shears are irrelevant. But then also notice how we don't have Barbara reporting that she saw Joan moving a stack of thorny trimmings. It's because that was concealed to win the numbers game. So then let's also take inventory of the numbers game otherwise at this point. Lillian is occupied by Barbara's son, and David is asleep, while Martin is gone. It isn't difficult to see Joan has created an environment in which she A, desired increased speed, and B, solitude. Increased speed and solitude are the two most prevalent elements of prey attempting to escape the wrath of a predator. They are the foundation for escape in nature, which equates to what? Freedom. So shortly before 2 p.m., Joan comes outside with Lillian and Barbara's son, unannounced to Barbara, and takes them back across the street to the Barker's house to play on a swing set. And guess where this swing set is located? In a position where you can't see the Risch home. So again, notice how Joan took action to affect the numbers game in her favor. But now she's laughing in evolution's face, and it's going to strike back. So what we should expect from a guilty person at this point is evidence of increased speed. And of course, we get it. But first, let me explain how this happens. This is nothing more than a transfer of energy, predicated upon light and heat, that radiates outward into the world from your actions against evolution. But since these actions are evil, they are, by default, born of darkness. So what evolution does is it swarms, circles you, and narrows that focus of light and energy back to the single point of its origin, which is you, and attacks with unrelenting darkness to compensate until the action against its well-being is entirely negated, once again, by the transfer of light and energy. It simply takes the light back. When you look through a microscope, telescope, your eyes, or any other type of lensed viewing device, its function is nothing more than a parallel to this notion. By transferring the focus of light and darkness within a circle, reality changes right before our eyes in a blink of an eye, or a turn of the knob. So at this point, Joan's deception is already causing the outward radiation of light. And light provides for ease of movement and greater freedom, which means we can, again, expect increased speeds on behalf of the perpetrator. Accordingly, 15 minutes later, neighbor Barbara Barker sees Joan hurrying up her driveway, wearing a trench coat over her clothes, and carrying something red in her outstretched arms. And when my eyes first glanced at these words, I seriously could not stop laughing at the simplicity of the implications here. Now let me elaborate on that. Okay, so going back to something I mentioned in the previous two episodes, what we understand about eyewitness testimony is that it renders great accuracy in terms of the identification of danger, but otherwise offers a very poor analysis of the situation. The reason for this, again, is that when you are faced with danger, your brain narrows the focal point of your vision to details that are the greatest threat to your survival. So, for instance, if a man is pointing a gun at you and then runs away, those are two details you will absolutely not forget when the cops ask you what happened. But what type of shoes he was wearing might have never occurred to you, simply because it doesn't matter to the plight of humanity. Your survival does, however, so the gun is absolutely never something you're going to miss. So let's look at what Barbara Barker saw in the driveway and determine why. The elements she notices are Joan wearing a trench coat, something red in her arms, and the fact she's moving quickly up the driveway toward the house from the car. Right off the bat, we understand the increased speed is an indication of danger, something predators and prey engage in the wild, which is directly tied to their immediate survival. Obviously, Barbara is going to take notice of this, and then she's wearing a trench coat. What makes this draw our eyes is that it's symbolic of concealment, in the sense that Joan is now only wearing it while utilizing increased speed. So we have increased speed and concealment, and finally Barbara notices something red in Joan's outstretched arms. Now I think it's hilarious, but also very truthful, that she only remembers the color and not anything related to what the object might have been. And here's why. Blood. In nature, increased speed and concealment are the identical dual strategies utilized by predators and prey in order to survive. But by default of the nature of the predator being more dominant, we know it's going to win this battle more often. Which means what? This event ends in a kill. Which is symbolized by what? Blood. And what is blood? Red. Barbara's portrayal of this event reveals that she did nothing more or less than try to establish if Joan was predator or prey at that moment. So obviously, because you don't expect your neighbor to stage a bloody disappearance one afternoon, the first thing you would do is rationalize that notion and identify a potential predator and think about who might be the potential prey, but only from a symbolic standpoint, as she hasn't actually identified a crime taking place. Therefore, the best fit is to say that she thought Joan was chasing the kids. It explains the increased speed, which then negates the suspicion that comes after because that's the requisite first step in the process. Of course, now that Barbara has deemed that there's no danger, notice that she goes away without even so much as an ounce of curiosity and can offer the police nothing more. It's because once she negated the perception of danger from the sight of the increased speed, she felt safe and went about her business, just like prey would in the wild. But what's really happening here is that Joan is hurrying up the driveway with the football in her arms in the immediate aftermath of the interception, and the other team is about to swarm to try to tackle her. Now, watch how this house of cards comes crashing down, and you'll immediately see the parallel to the need for increased speed in nature. But, to be honest, Joan does a pretty good job of offsetting this one at first. Check this out. Joan realizes that the first person evolution is going to pit against her plight is Barbara Barker, meaning that Barbara is going to be on the lookout for her kid eventually. But what Joan did to counteract this is to take the kids over to the Barker's house and leave them at the swing set without telling Barbara. So basically, when the first crack in Joan's plan becomes evolution's plight to protect Barbara's child, Joan heads off this inevitable swarm by placing the child in a location where Barbara will find him and have no reason to proceed further because the danger has been proven false, even if by way of a lie. Which can only mean one thing. The swarm will continue. Soon after, the daughter of the Rish's neighbor, Virginia Keene, arrives home and notices a two-tone General Motors car in the Rish's driveway. Of course, she doesn't recognize this vehicle, so it raises suspicions in her mind. In fact, about 5 minutes later, another neighbor reportedly stops his car in the street to allow a car of this description to back out of either the Rish's driveway or the neighbor's. He wasn't sure which driveway, but when the cops asked the Rish's neighbors, they said they didn't see anyone pull into or out of theirs. So while young David continues to sleep upstairs in the Rish household, the swarm is going to intensify outside because the time has come that Barbara Barker has errands to run and needs to take Joan's daughter Lillian back home to her mother. So it would be commonplace back then for people to leave their doors open during the day. So what ends up happening is Barbara takes Lillian across the street and makes sure she goes into the house safely, then she leaves. What she doesn't know is that Joan is already gone. At that point, 3:40 p.m., Barbara goes out to run her errands and returns 35 minutes later at 4:15 p.m. That's when 4-year-old Lillian comes back across the street from the Rish home and utters these famous words to Barbara. Mommy is gone and the kitchen is covered in red paint. She goes on to say her brother is still in his crib, but now he's crying because he needs his diaper changed. So you can see how the swarm is circling, because this is the point where authority figures are going to be called to action. There's no going back, because at 4:33 p.m., when Barbara sees the bloody mess in the kitchen, she calls the police. But wait, you say, the car in the driveway. No, she was abducted. that wasn't her car. It was a man who attacked her, abducted her, and then murdered her, only to hide her body in the aftermath. But you see, this is where Joan doesn't fool me one bit. I'm looking for the symbolism. And there it is. Witnesses say the car was two-tone, and immediately my interest is piqued because I already know what colors the symbolism dictates must happen here. So we learn from one of the witnesses that the car was definitely blue and one other color. So if I go with my hunch and then back that up with a little research, what this seems to reveal is that the most likely color combination for this car would have been blue and white. And what did I say about Joan's outfit she changed into just a minute back? We know, by default, that it has to parallel what she does when changing cars. Just as the sneakers and a lighter house dress offered increased speed, so does a car. They're all part of the same plight here, which is freedom, symbolized by blue and white for an open sky. However, a lot of people believe this event could have been a failed abortion, but the truth beneath the evidence tells me otherwise. Parallels. What has always been the biggest opposition to abortion in America, from the standpoint of ideals? It's conservatism. So in order to determine if this crime scene could be the product of a botched abortion, a murder, or even staged, we absolutely must determine this by way of conservatism. Here's what I mean. In any given situation, as I've said many times on the show, humans take the most conservative action possible to get what they want, no matter how explosively violent or unreasonable it may seem to others. So when you rob a convenience store, no matter how desperate you might be to do that, you're probably not walking in with an anti-aircraft gun mounted on your shoulder. It exceeds the necessity in a way that actually damages your chances of success by default of one thing: detection. We remain conservative at all times to avoid excessive detection in nature. So when examining a crime scene for the truth of what actually happened, one can determine if it's staged by a propensity for liberal application of planted evidence that falsely enforces the fact it's genuine. Now let's go inside the house. The first thing to note in this situation is that the total amount of blood we're about to discuss only amounts to approximately half a pint, according to chemists. But in terms of appearance, it seems to be quite a bit. To give an example of how this works, if you place a small amount of liquid on a teaspoon, it doesn't seem like very much, but if you fling it across the room, you're going to get a significant trail of the substance. The reason for this change in perception is that the liquid concentrated in one spot on the spoon occurs to you in terms of volume, but when spread intermittently across a two-dimensional surface, or a seemingly two-dimensional surface, it becomes something much different, which is this: a story. Wherever you have a trail, you have a story. The blood, therefore, takes on an emotional context, which in this case becomes the question, what happened to Joan? So, the cops enter the kitchen of the home and find blood smeared on the walls. The table is overturned, and the phone has been ripped from a mount on the wall and placed in a wastebasket. A roll of paper towels is on the floor, soaked with blood from somebody's hand, and some of the blood on the floor is also smeared. But get this. There are no footprints in the blood. No shoe prints. Just smeared blood on the floor and walls of the kitchen. It was type O, which matched Joan Rich's type. But since she had disappeared, there was no way to acquire a sample from her to determine if it was specifically hers. Also in the wastebasket is an empty liquor bottle, which Martin said he and Joan had finished the night before, and then a handful of empty beer bottles Martin said were absolutely not theirs. Of course, the wastebasket was normally kept under the kitchen sink, so it had been removed from that location and placed in the center of the kitchen floor. In addition, a telephone directory was opened on the kitchen counter to a page designated for writing your emergency numbers, but none had been written. So Joan left the trench coat behind, but another of her coats was missing. Then we find another drop of blood at the bottom of the stairs leading to the second floor, as well as two more drops at the top of the stairs, eight in the master bedroom, and finally, a drop near a window in the kid's bedroom. The blood drops then lead out the kitchen door to the driveway, where the police find more leading to Joan's car, which was smeared with blood on the right rear fender, the left side of the hood near the windshield, and the center of the trunk. Now, I'm not sure if they mean the trunk lid or inside the trunk, but I honestly don't think it matters because I already know what the police are going to determine. And they do. There's no story here. they can't understand where the bleeding started. What they know is they have no footprints and a blood trail that leads to a car that's still in the driveway when multiple witnesses saw another car leave from behind it. So, looking at this scene, I have to be honest in saying that there isn't any way I can rationalize this crime as being perpetrated by an outside party. Blood evidence tells a story, and the only one this is telling lacks authenticity. The dismantled phone indicates a use of blunt force, but the crime scene indicates disorientation from an injury leading to smeared blood. Yet then we have the precise effort of not leaving bloody footprints while disoriented. Plus, the emergency numbers page didn't have blood on it, so how did the smears get on the wall from somebody's hand? So what we find over and over is a lack of consistency, and there's seemingly no justifiable order to the events for one very specific reason. There didn't have to be. A struggle tells a story of trying to overcome something. There is not one shred of evidence at this scene that dictates a person tried to overcome anything. Notice how the blood flow stops at Joan's car, and not where the one behind it was. The reason is that the second car does one thing the rest of the evidence does not, and that's this. It tells a story. So suddenly, as though it's a miracle, the bleeding is now under control while Joan is being moved to a vehicle outside, when up to this point the ground has been covered in drops of blood. Conversely, inside the house, we're being sold nothing more than confusion, a grand contrivance that would have John and Patsy Ramsey nodding in appreciation. There's no sign of a struggle, and the signs of disorientation are entirely false. Here's why. As goal-oriented people, there's a very strong relationship between our desires and the direction our feet are facing. So when something happens that causes our brains to become disoriented, the first thing it does in response is to repetitively seek context until it perceives a satisfactory response from the body's actions. So one of the strongest physical affectations of disorientation is disagreement between the intentions of the brain and the actions of the body, which plays out in the form of reconsideration, again and again. What therefore happens is that the reconsideration often causes you to continue to try different methods of escaping the circumstance. In an enclosed kitchen, this means one thing. It is virtually impossible to have not stepped in the blood in a disoriented state while bleeding. So as a matter of probability, it would be far more likely that the blood was placed there by an effort that was specifically intended to have that result. The odds tell us that's what happened. And then there's this. Little David's coverall and a pair of his underpants were on the floor in the kitchen. The coverall was matted to the floor, as though a body had lain on it and smeared blood. But let's examine this nonsense. The blood trail leads outside in a manner that suggests the person lying on the floor either got up and walked out, or was picked up and carried out. But that couldn't have happened due to simple anatomical considerations. You see, to pick up the body, you have to step in the blood. And to get up off the floor while in the blood, well, you get it. You gotta step in it. What makes more sense is this. This mother knows that when somebody finds this scene, David will have already awakened and thoroughly shit himself into a good scream. If the neighbor or cops then arrive to see this, they'll want to correlate an event taking place that stopped her from changing the kid due to the underpants and coverall lying on the floor. She'll appear to have been interrupted. But again, the only struggle we have here is Joan's emotional plight, and the evidence is so fucking obviously planted. I mean, the kid is upstairs, so you would change him upstairs, and there isn't a circumstance that warrants bringing those items downstairs. Again, it serves no purpose but confusion. So, I definitely conclude that this was nothing more than a charade concocted by Joan in a desperate attempt to escape her life. And then we learn this. She had checked out more than 25 true crime and mystery books from the library that summer, including one entitled Into Thin Air, in which a woman disappears under almost identical circumstances to Joan's. Now, that doesn't amount to evidence, but for those of you who are mothers of multiple young children, I just want to ask a question that doesn't even need to be answered. Did you get an opportunity to read 25 books this past summer? Probably not. It's a lot of reading for a busy person. But you would do it if it brought you peace. If you couldn't stand the thought of reality. And what's another term we use to describe these activities? Escapism. Because the truth is this. Do you know who reads 25 books over the summer? not a housewife doing casual reading for excitement. The type of person who reads this many books in publishing is called an editor. That's the life and career path Joan was forced to leave. And notice how it becomes the adapter to the port of her desires and fuels the eclipse of the shadow that Jung talked about, the one where we realize who we truly are by way of our dark side coming into the light. The fantasy contained within these books was the method of transit from one life to the next. And that's why the crime scene is a fucking mess. It's just fantasy. Okay, so I just want to go back in the house one more time and pick another example of how ridiculous this is. We have a blood drop on the bottom stair leading to the second floor, and then no more drops on any other stairs, but the drops begin again on the landing at the top. What physics would tell us is that this is a lie, as the body requires greater torque, or force, when walking up and down stairs than it does on flat surfaces, due to the nature of working against gravity and trying to not only propel yourself up the stairs, but also preventing yourself from collapsing and tumbling down them as your body descends. So with greater torque, we naturally have greater impact as well, which would lead to a greater propensity for blood to drop. Yet, we find one drop of blood on a single stair, meaning the impact of walking on dozens of them produced a single blood drop, while walking on the flat surface above with less torque and impact resulted in more blood falling from the body. It's just not reasonable, or even possible. You just simply cannot defy science by way of circumstance and have the end result appear to be the truth. The crime scene betrays even the most basic anatomical considerations for an attack or accident of any kind and is born of nothing less than total and unrelenting desperation. And that's how she ends up dead. The injury that was inflicted upon her to produce the blood was, by default of parallels, also born of this same faulty anatomical logic. So if what she intended in the house to appear as murder ends up just appearing as confusion, that's the same fucking thing that's going to happen to her due to this injury. Accordingly, we then get no fewer than two reports of a disoriented, disheveled woman matching Joan's appearance, walking aimlessly along nearby roads while clutching her stomach. The reports also include mention of blood and or mud running down her legs. But what we learn is there's a good chance it's both. Blood because of the situation we just discussed, and mud because guess where she was spotted? Here's where the symbolism comes into play. Joan was seen by these witnesses walking along a road next to a construction site where a new road was being built, and then nobody ever saw her again. So it's speculated that perhaps she fell into a construction ditch or hole of some kind and was covered before she even had the chance to decompose and be detected. So here are my thoughts on that. I think it's exactly what happened. Here's why. If we assume she was bleeding and becoming disoriented, even if she intended to get help, she might not have been capable of doing so by the time it dawned on her that the problem was so bad. In that light, let's take a closer look at what happens to the brain while disoriented. The first sign of disorientation is loss of context. You'll first realize that you don't understand why you just took the preceding action. So again, what happens is reconsideration. But as the problem gets worse through blood loss, your ability to capture nuance and turn it into context fades quickly. As it does, and you move closer to death, your brain becomes more and more primal in an effort to only expend energy on that which might aid survival. So whereas you would begin by relying on trying to recompute the initial transmission that didn't work the first time around, after that fails repeatedly, your brain reaches to the depths of evolution to rely on anything, right down to symbolism. For example, I once knew a diabetic guy who blacked out while walking down the street on his way to give himself a shot. But when he woke up, he was on the floor of a nearby fast food restaurant with sugar available and help on its way. What happened is once he blacked out, his brain just propelled his body into a location where it had been trained to understand the necessary help would be available. And it was right. But had this happened in a remote location, we'd have instead been talking about his funeral. And this is what happens to Joan Risch. While walking aimlessly toward the construction site for a new road, the symbolic implication is this: change. That's what she was seeking all along. Movement toward change on a road that leads to a new place. That is Joan Risch being spotted walking toward this place. But ultimately she realizes what we do. All roads end in the same place, which of course is death. So delirious, bleeding, and on the verge of passing out, Joan curls up in a hole, seeking comfort in the way many dying people do when exposed to nature. The logic here is this. It's a frequent occurrence that people walk off into nature and are never seen again. Too often we dismiss this occurrence as animal predation or foul play, when in reality what's normally likely is that the victim succumbed to exposure after getting injured and/or lost. Absolutely everybody who lives in a mountainous region knows a routine hiking trip on a sunny afternoon could turn disastrous very quickly. Nature is unforgiving, and circumstances arise which are out of your control in the absence of doing your best to react and survive. You could encounter a rattlesnake or a bear, or simply slip and break your ankle 5 miles into a hike. You could even forget your water. But whatever the case may be, when things go wrong while taking a journey on foot, your body is going to break down. And the rough terrain means it's going to happen even faster than it normally would in your hasty attempt to find help. So as I previously mentioned evolution circling you and swarming, as it narrows the scope of light you created with the snatch and grab back to darkness at the point it reaches your body, the same thing happens within your body thereafter. It permeates your existence. As it has permanently restricted your physical movement and brought the circle of light back down to the pinpoint of your existence, evolution essentially now needs to turn off the light switch on your life by restricting the movement inside your body. So in Joan's case, we have to assume blood loss led to disorientation, and her most primal motivating factors then led her to the symbolism of the construction site for the new road. Now, her physical state suggests her movement will be restricted in a manner that will have her forced to stop walking, either by falling or by finding shelter. Of course, I believe that the latter, finding shelter, is not only a more primal motivating factor, but a far more likely reason someone wouldn't be found. Here's why. We, like every other creature, are constructed to disguise weakness because it alerts predators to our condition. For example, if you and another person are up for the same promotion at work, you're probably not going to announce to your boss that you just started seeing a psychiatrist. Now, in the modern world and civilization, we know there's nothing wrong with this, but we still cater to the perception because we know the evolutionary implications are apparent. We say things like, it's okay to admit it, in situations where evolutionary considerations make us feel one way, and our civilized modifications make us realize a more enlightened perspective in spite of that. So, as the swarm of evolution cripples Joan's body, her propensity for primal thinking will kick into high gear. So what the brain will do is find things that mimic the locations that bring you the most comfort, in a generalized way. For instance, in the modern world, four walls and a roof with an enclosed entrance is the ideal shelter for any human, and essentially how almost all of us live these days. Even more primal is people inhabiting caves, which would be more consistent with the earliest forms of humanity, and a resort Joan's brain would entertain when the former suggestion was unattainable within the time allotted before she collapsed. Of course, we know four-walled structures are best because they shelter us not only from the weather, but also predators of all kinds. Meanwhile, three-walled structures with open fronts prevent weather from overhead, but invite predators from the front. So for instance, if Joan climbed or fell into a three-walled sewer drain with an open front, she might have drowned. But if she climbed into something with the intention of also concealing herself from predators, she would have chosen something that mimicked four walls and a roof. The problem with that is A, she wouldn't be seen, and B, she's at a construction site. So what isn't accounted for in this primal logic is one simple factor, accidental predation. Joan has chosen to walk through a construction site, and by nature of what her reaction would be due to her injury, and the fact she's never found, it seems as though she concealed herself. But people on construction sites wear neon vests, hard hats, and steel-toed boots for a reason. Because it's a dangerous place to work. And that's for somebody paying attention. She could have easily climbed into a cardboard box that was inside a large dumpster and been covered by debris from a backhoe or similar. Any number of things could have happened. And one of them likely did. So the whole point of this is to say that when we are sick or injured, and most vulnerable, we seek isolation in the absence of others, even to the point that we do it in the civilized world by calling out of work when we have the flu. And even then, we confine ourselves even further, remaining in one room if we don't have to move except to go to the kitchen or bathroom. The reason is that by lack of detection and way of concealment, we have an effective way to fend off predators, especially when sick or injured, and even if it's just your needy coworkers looking for the reports you were supposed to finish. It's a great survival tool for situations like times when you don't want to answer a collections call from a creditor. But if you're bleeding and disoriented, you need to get your ass to a hospital. The act of concealment after injury or sickness is a last-ditch effort to survive in the wild, one where your only hope of recovery is to be afforded enough time to get well, if you're lucky enough to do that. So ultimately, concealment proves itself an effective strategy to accomplish one thing, and to do it well. And that's concealment, which is why we never see Joan Risch again and have no leads. The bottom line here is that we simply don't have any definitive evidence of a second party being involved, especially in a malicious manner. We do have the two-tone car, which I imagine Joan probably stole or borrowed somewhere and actually returned before taking her trek on foot. If the car was missing from the driveway, then it was driven before she started walking. And if she was abducted, nobody would have seen her walking the roads by the construction site. The blood-mud combo also suggests she likely fell and mixed the substances on her legs, and a second fall, a worse fall, or a total collapse of the body shortly thereafter is not far-fetched in any way. So while there are many more nuances of this case I could discuss, I think I'm going to wrap it up here with a few thoughts about those left behind in the wake of Joan's disappearance. And for anyone who still thinks she was murdered, I totally agree it's possible. But what I truly believe is that this case is ironic in the most bittersweet of ways. Joan Risch indulged in the fantasy of faking her murder and starting a new life, but ultimately, through these actions, took her own life, the only one she would ever know. And in the end, the result was the same. But whether it's by murder, collapsing in a ditch due to blood loss, or just passing from natural causes, eventually we all find that change we seek, waiting at the end of the road. And that place is peace. Yet for Martin Risch and the couple's two children, there would be none. At least, not in this lifetime. The family stayed in the home until 1975, when it was purchased as part of an improvement project for the park in which it was located. The house was relocated elsewhere, but Martin stayed nearby in another house, never remarrying and always hoping one day Joan would return. In fact, he refused to ever change their phone number, right up until his death in 2009. And what I find so devastating about this notion is that all along, and even in death, Joan was adored by a man who never gave up on her, who undoubtedly looked out the window and sat by the phone every night for almost 50 years, hoping one day it would ring and hating himself because he knew it never would. It's as sad as it is beautiful, as crushing as it is uplifting. But no matter what the truth may be, and whether they were right or wrong, ultimately both of them made decisions based in denial. It did so for the same reason all of us do. Love. And perhaps that's the only truth we ever need to know. We're all just looking for love. Hopelessly. Endlessly. Relentlessly. Until we walk into the valley of death, where a sudden eclipse of darkness buzzes with the swarm of evolution and swallows what's left of the light.